In today's episode, we are joined by Elaine Lynn Herrin. Elaine is an expert in empowering people to use their voice. She is the author of the USA Today bestseller, Unlearning Silence, a book that delves into the roots of silence and helps the reader to unlearn silence in order to fully unleash their talent, speak their mind, and to be a more complete version of themselves. In this episode, Elaine shares how we learn to silence ourselves and how we can learn to unsilence ourselves. She also discusses the responsibility that leaders play in creating environments where individuals are heard. Welcome, Elaine. It's great to have you on this podcast.
Wonderful to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
You've written this wonderful book, Unlearning Silence, that we're going to dive into today. Before we get started, it would be great to hear a little bit about yourself, your career journey, and how you've ended up writing this book.
Yeah, absolutely. In particular, because I think my journey is like most people's. I am not at all doing what I thought I would be doing. So I wanted to be a lawyer. I went to law school intending to be a litigator, and I said from the time I was 11 that I wanted to do that. And so I went to Harvard Law School, was a student there, figured that was my life path forward, and there discovered negotiation and conflict management theory and practice. Essentially, how do we talk to each other more effectively? How do we actually work together? And fell into a path of self-discovery, personal growth, and also realized, well, other than sue each other and blow each other up, there's actually a lot we can do in terms of communicating with one another. So I accidentally went down this path of leadership development, teaching skills for negotiation, difficult conversations, giving and receiving feedback, which of course is how I ended up. I call myself an accidental author. I didn't set out to write a book, but looked at what I saw as the gaps in what was in leadership books and theory and leadership development, which is how I got to Unlearning Silence.
I started reading this book. Here it is for anybody that's not seen it. I've started bookmarking it and highlighting it like crazy. So I was just saying to Elaine before we got started that this seems like the book that I've always needed. So I work in tech and it is heavily male dominated. Yeah. So this book definitely resonates. We're going to dive into some of the chapters of this book to give people a taste of what the book contains, and also just to share some insights for everybody listening and potentially provide some strategies on how the listeners can overcome the silence that they're experiencing in their lives. So let's just first start with discussing how silence shows up. In your experience, how do people experience silence within the workspace or within their own personal lives?
I love this question because there's so much in the world touting the benefits of silence. Like, you need that meditative pause. We need to stop between stimulus and response. You know, I think all of that is true, and we as a society would benefit from it. And the silence I'm talking about is when you're not invited to the meeting, when someone talks over you, when someone interrupts, when someone steals your idea and takes credit. When you say the same thing and no one seems to pick up on it, and 10 minutes later, Bill says this exact same thing, and everyone's like, oh my gosh, that's genius. We have to do that. It is also when everyone else's priorities, preferences take all the energy in the room, and it feels like there's not actually room for me. There's not room for my ideas, perspectives, preferences in this mix. And of course, what we've learned over time, which is chapter one, how do we learn silence, right? We learn silence by the look that our mom, our dad, our uncle gave us when we asked a question, when we pushed back, right? When other people laughed at us. As a matter of self-preservation, we learn to not rock the boat, right? We are rewarded for being the easy team player when we do what we're told, except it then doesn't serve us as we move up higher in leadership. But silence is when you feel like you have to self-censor, when you have to edit. It is also when other people cut you out of the conversation. Other people don't think to invite you. Other people make it too costly for you to share what you really think. And so silence then makes sense.
Are there differences in the way in which men and women, the experiences that they've had that lead to silence?
I mean, one of the conversations is silence a woman's issue, right? You hear a lot, women need to speak up, women need to negotiate more. And some of that to me is we're asking the wrong question. Because if the problem statement is women need to speak up, then essentially women go fix yourselves. And when you fix yourselves, then you'll be heard, then you'll get the promotion, then we can promote you or you can run the company. Except that analysis fails to take into account the ways that leaders silence each other, that we silence each other as colleagues, the biases and the stereotypes. You know, if a woman doesn't fit into the expectation, particularly a woman of color, right? I am from Taiwan. I present as I identify as an Asian American woman. I'm supposed to be quiet and docile. And so if I have an opinion, then I am out of the range of Adam Galinsky, a social psychologist out of New York, says the range of acceptable behavior. But the range of acceptable behavior is actually determined by the stereotypes and biases that we have. So I would say that silence is disproportionately impacts women, and we can unpack why. And so, as silence is not a woman's issue, silence is a leadership issue. If you as a leader are silencing the people on your team, or those people do not feel comfortable, think it is too costly for them to share what they really think, you are not getting essential data and information that you need to make sound decisions, right? Essentially, you're living in a skewed sense of reality because you don't have the data that women or other people have but are staying silent about. And of course, silence disproportionately impacts women because silence disproportionately impacts people who carry subordinated identities in any ecosystem, meaning the majority, in particularly in tech, right? We talk about male-dominant environments. Anytime you carry an identity that is part of the dominant group, that behavior is seen as normal. You are more likely to get the benefit of the doubt. Anytime you do not carry that dominant identity, you are more likely to be othered, more likely to be questioned. It is an uphill battle to be heard, at which point, you know, our logical brain and our emotional brain is like, you know what? It actually makes more sense for me to stay silent, because if every time I speak up, people are going to get defensive, people are going to retaliate. And by the way, I still carry a disproportionate amount of the childcare household work globally, right? I don't have energy to fight this uphill battle. Then silence makes sense, you know? And of course, that is chapter 3 of the book, because the reality is, particularly when it comes to harassment or even whistleblowing, speaking up can be incredibly costly. And at the same time, that's why I'd go back to silence being a leadership issue. Silence doesn't have to be costly if leaders are actually welcoming and rewarding voice. So many leaders say, I want to hear what you have to say. But when we say it, it's like, oh, but not that actually. Or say that with a smile, or say that less directly, right? It is up to each of us to be able to listen across difference, to make it less costly for us each to share what we really think and be able to offer those perspectives that are essential for doing good work together.
Our audience are aspiring and early stage founders, female founders. So they are leaders themselves. They are building teams. They are leading. Let's first begin by talking about, what are some of the problems that you've seen within teams when silence is an issue? And then we can go into talking about how to solve that so that our listeners can start building teams where people are heard.
Yeah. Yeah. Two main sort of symptoms of teams where silence is undercutting, I would say, their effectiveness. One is that people don't say what they really think or feel in the actual meeting. So you get a lot of side channeling, a lot of the meeting after the meeting, right? Whether virtual or in person, you're in the meeting, the leader says, what do you think? Or what's going on? Let's solve it. People sort of stay silent. You end up with groupthink, another symptom. And then afterwards, you get a bunch of, you know, we're in Slack. oh my God, can you believe that happened? Did blah, blah, blah. But we're not actually saying it to each other. So the symptom would be the side channeling, the meeting after the meeting, and the result is groupthink, which of course we know can be incredibly dangerous. That is probably the main piece. And the other aspect of it is why that is so damaging, right? Because particularly for women, if we are silencing ourselves or being silenced, we internalize that message of, oh, I'm the problem. Right? You're too emotional. You don't understand this context. And it's like, well, what if we do understand it and we see it differently, or we understand it even better? And it's that other people aren't ready or able to hear it. So it manifests in that self-doubt, in the second-guessing ourselves, rather than, oh, this is what I think. This is the insight that I have. Or particularly if you're thinking about starting something, you know, do I even have a good idea? Is this a pursuit that is worthwhile if it's never been done before? At the core of innovation is difference, right? So doing something that is new or novel is going to be inherently different. And we can so often doubt whether that is worthwhile, particularly who's willing to fund it, whether other people think it is a good idea. Yeah, I think of Spanx, and no one understood the product because the people who investors hadn't dealt with the challenge of pantyhose and smoothness and panty lines and all of that, right? Who are the people who currently have authority? What are their perspectives? How might those perspectives be limited? And then are we going to internalize those limitations versus building a different ecosystem, building a different way? And of course, this is why the book is titled Unlearning Silence. Because we've so often learned and built these unconscious habits that we don't even realize are there and impacting us. And of course, impacting the people around us as well.
Mm-hmm. Have you got some examples where silence has been like detrimental to a company?
I mean, every corporate scandal of the 21st and 20th centuries, right? Mm-hmm. In the book, I talk about Enron, most recently Boeing. Right. If you take Boeing, which impacts anyone who flies and is fundamentally a safety concern, Enron was lots of money and sort of financial things and livelihoods. But this is a fundamental safety issue. And actually, the whistleblower in Boeing was a man. So we don't even have the gendered issue that we were talking about. And I don't cite this to make it even more discouraging for women. Right. But the whistleblower spoke up. I think 5 years before going public with it, was told, oh, that's not an issue, let it go, raised it again, was transferred to another unit, right? Every time he spoke up was sidelined, management didn't seem to want to hear it. He finally went public. And of course, the toll that whistleblowing takes on an individual's body is, I mean, he ended his life as a result of it with the mental, emotional, physical toll. So not to be flippant about it, but, you know, we look at every corporate scandal. We look at everything that sort of fell apart in terms of design. And somewhere along the way, there's usually someone who said something. And so this notion of women speak up or women don't ask, that's fundamentally the problem. The latest research out of UC Berkeley has shown that's actually not the problem anymore. It's that women do speak up, do so more than men, in fact, and are disproportionately penalized for doing so and more likely to be told no. So where does that leave us? To me, that leaves us at the place where, look, if we really want to crack this code where each of us can bring forth at work our best thoughts, build amazing things that make the world a better place, we need to solve and unlearn not just the silence we might have internalized, but the ways that even well-intentioned leaders silence the very people they claim to support.
Yeah. Let's talk about how we can navigate that space. So First of all, in what ways can we start to recognize the ways in which we silence ourselves. Because I think that sometimes these patterns become so ingrained that we don't actually recognize it, or we aren't even aware of it.
Totally. This is chapter 4 of the book. And so I'll do a diet light version because there's, of course, a lot more depth there. Yeah. I'll name two traps. The first trap is, do we actually say the thing to the person? And what I mean by that is, if we have a frustrating experience at work, we'll complain to our friends. We might, you know, whoever we live with, our roommates, our spouses, our partners, we might even say it to the person at checkout at the grocery store as they ask me, you know, how was your day? And what happens when you repeat a narrative is what psychologists call the illusory truth effect. Meaning, because you have repeated the story or the narrative enough times, it tricks your brain into thinking that you might have actually had that same conversation with the actual person involved, right? You're pissed at your manager, you've complained to all your friends, family, they've known about it for months, and they're like, well, what did your manager say when you raised it with them? And it's almost, we trick ourselves into thinking we've had the conversation with our manager when we haven't. Right, the person of interest, whoever that might be. So one way we silence ourselves is actually talking with everybody but the person. Another way we silence ourselves is what researchers call mitigated speech. Malcolm Gladwell popularized this with his book Outliers, even though he didn't create it. But that in our speech patterns, there's a range of directness, from hints to questions to observations to suggestions, proposals, and then commands. And so often, you know, think about it, you're out with a group of friends and you're getting hungry and you're like, hey, are you all hungry? And when I talk with women, if I use this example in a speech in a room full of women, they're like, oh, when someone says, are you hungry? That actually, they know that means I'm hungry. Mm-hmm. Right. But not everybody knows that. Because it was a question, you know, I ask my brother, are you hungry? And he's like, nope. Oh, darn you for not understanding and being inconsiderate to my needs. Except when we think about it from the outside, unless you know the code and are speaking in the same code, you can't actually understand that are you hungry means I am hungry, I want to go get something to eat, or I'm hungry, we should go get something to eat. And so one way we silence ourselves or dampen the message is by not being as clear as we think we are. And we as human beings all do it. And you take into account differences across culture, right? Families of origins, geography, as well as power dynamics in a relationship. And what we think we're screaming in our heads because it is so clear to us versus what is actually externalized, there's often quite a large gap. So the way to solve for that, of course, is to check for the gap. What am I thinking? What did I actually say? Did I actually have the conversation with that person? Or do I just have a narrative of them in my head that is calcified because of how many times I've repeated the story to someone else? Now, of course, the beauty of keeping the story to yourself is that you get to write the script about how your manager's a villain, how they're inflexible, how they never listen to you. But how would they listen to you if you haven't actually said something to them? So those are a couple of ways that we silence ourselves in terms of what we say. And then the other big piece that particularly impacts women because of how the world sees us is, in what ways do we silence our own needs? Am I aware of what I need, what I want? Do I think it's a possibility to solve for the things that I need or I want? Particularly motherhood tends to strip that out of you. You're supposed to be self-sacrificial, do everything. Do it with a smile, be unflappable, even when you're exhausted. So paying attention to what do I think, what do I need? So talking about how do we recultivate our voice or unlearn our silence? A really low-hanging fruit way of doing that is asking yourself two questions. This is internal work. It's not visible. We're not yet engaging with other people, so it's pretty low cost. But as you're listening to this podcast, or you're reading a book, or scanning the news, be asking yourself, what do I think? Not what does my manager think, not what does my mother think or want of me, but what do I think? And second would be, what do I need? right? Paying attention to what we need rather than denying our own needs or saying, I could just push through, and asking those two questions, what do I think, what do I need, re-nurtures our voice, meaning re-nurtures our awareness and rebuilds our awareness to, oh, I do have thoughts, feelings, needs, preferences of my own. And then it makes it really hard not to do something about it.
What came to mind as you were speaking is that when you meet somebody that does this really well, because I do know an example of a woman in my life that does this really well, it is so refreshing and exemplary. And it makes me think, that's how you do it. She just so clearly just stated exactly what she wants, what she's not happy with, and what she wants.
Yeah. You know, the funny thing is our ability to be aware of and to communicate what we need increases or want, increases the likelihood that other people can actually support us in that way. Over time, it feels like we've been trained to not have needs, not have preferences, because that makes you easy to work with, right? Then you're not a burden, you're not overbearing, except the other people around us, particularly those who genuinely love us, right? Family members, romantic partners, are sort of guessing, how can I show up for you, Babisha? And they often don't get it right. They're in the dark versus, you know what? What I really need today is some alone time. Great. Like, go away. Don't contact me. And then we come back actually more nourished, more able to do the things that we want. Or in the workplace, right? Do our managers, the leaders, the colleagues around us know what feedback we need? And by feedback, I mean those three types: appreciation, coaching, and evaluation. Maybe all they give us is appreciation, because they have a hard time delivering quote-unquote bad news. But I am hungry and starved for coaching. I don't want to know what's working well. I want to know what I can do better, right? How do I improve from your perspective? What is one thing I could change that would make a difference to our team dynamic? I'm actually looking for some tactical, operational things I can do. If we can communicate that's actually what I'm looking for, then there's an increased likelihood that they can provide it, versus we say we want more feedback and they're like, oh, you're doing great. That was fantastic. And it's like, that's not what I was looking for, right? I'm looking for tactical coaching in this area of how we work together.
Earlier, you spoke about people being afraid of asking what they need because of the consequences. Mm-hmm. How do we communicate in our way, our needs in a way, or our thoughts or our opinion on an important topic without becoming penalized for it? Yeah. Or without that having that fear potentially?
Lack of fear and comfort are really poor indicators of whether you should do something. So if we're waiting around to the point where we don't have any fear around asking, I'm not sure that time is going to come anytime soon. Right. If we wait, if we're looking for, I have to feel completely comfortable and confident in order to express my perspective, that's a really high bar. So for me, it is less about having no fear as deciding what we want to do with that fear and how it fits into our calculation. It is less about feeling completely comfortable and more about, is it worth it to me? Is it worth the risk? Is it worth at times even the cost to say something so that I am better known, so that my voice, my perspectives are represented, so that I might get my needs met? Whatever your bigger why is, and this is in chapter 7 of the book in terms of using your voice, right? What is your bigger why? Because I don't think we're ever going to get to a place of not having fear. So this whole face your fears. Okay, there's the fear. That's what I'm worried about. Here's the potential upside. Here's the potential downside. Where do I want to show up in the midst of all of that? So to me, speaking up, using your voice, shaping the world, and building the career or company that you want is less about confidence, less about courage, even though those are both helpful, and less about not having any fear so much as, what is the calculation? In your calculation, is it worth it? Is it worth it to try? Is it worth it to say something? And the beautiful thing about calculation is everyone else around you can actually play a role in your calculation. So if you work on a team right now, if you knew for sure that when you shared a perspective, your manager or your peer would hear you, appreciate you, even reward you, even if it's a quote unquote dissenting opinion, how much more likely would we be to share what we really think? And so I would turn it to what is our individual and collective responsibility to change the calculation for one another, right? For leaders to build the skill to be able to hear different perspectives, listen across difference. The other piece that can, that I think is our collective responsibility is how do we lower the stakes? And actually this is chapter 7 of the book in terms of the three levers. Quick spoiler, three levers for voice: substance, relationship, process. Substance being the what, relationship being the who and how we feel treated by each other, and process being the how. And to me, process is that not sexy, totally underrated stepsister of the three, meaning how we set up the ways that we communicate either make it easier or make it harder for people to share what they think. So a lot of times, particularly with hierarchy, right? If a manager says, tell me what you think, often the people more junior on the team are thinking, oh my God, that's a trap, right? I know that that's not actually what you want to hear, or how honest do you want me to be, right? Someone said something last meeting and it didn't go well, you snapped at them. So what do you think as an open-ended question, however well-intentioned, doesn't make it any easier for people to actually answer the question candidly, versus if the leader, the manager says, you know, what are the pros of this idea? What about this works? And then follows it up with the next agenda item, which is what are the cons? What about this doesn't work? So that instead of having to speak up, having to push back, having to dissent and do all the calculated risks of that, that we build it into the way that we as a team process information or evaluate ideas. Okay, we all know we're going to answer the same two questions, however boring, every time. What are the pros? What are the cons? What about this works? What about this doesn't work? You know, whatever language works for your culture, but then you are naturally inviting in the quote unquote dissent that is so often really hard for people to raise and feels incredibly risky versus, okay, now we're moving on to question number two that we always answer, which is, what about this doesn't work? What concerns do you have? What are the cons? And we end up having much healthier, much more productive conversations because of how we set up the conversation.
Hmm. Yeah. I've been in lots of meetings, in something that people listening that are building teams will have to look forward to. There are a couple of scenarios that come to mind. So when you were talking, so one is the hippo problem. So yeah, we spoke about earlier how important it is for innovation when you're building innovative solutions to have different perspectives and also evaluate lots of different ideas. One situation that comes up a lot in tech is the hippo problem, where, you know, the highest paid person or the founder in the team, you know, they'll express their idea, and like you said, it just creates groupthink. People will like latch on to that idea. How would you navigate a particular scenario?
Yeah, so just listeners, HIPPO being an acronym for highest paid person in the room, right? And because they're highest paid, they usually are also everyone's boss. So there are a lot of different process pieces you could do. One is, and this is in the book as well, does that highest paid person actually have to be there? Because so often when the highest paid person is there, everyone is just like, you know, sucking up or trying to toe the party line or say the thing that they think that person wants. So I would actually back up and say, what is the purpose of this meeting? And if the purpose of the meeting also then begs the question, given the purpose of this meeting, who should actually be there or not be there? Because the power dynamics are real. the assumptions of we need to do stakeholder management and manage up well and get on the, you know, boss's good side. All of that is so deeply ingrained and real in our dynamics. You know, you don't want to cross the person who signs your paychecks figuratively or literally. So one is who should actually be in that room? And for leaders, do we have the awareness that actually sometimes we can best serve a process or a purpose by not being there? Because if we're there, everyone is trying to solve for us. The other is for leaders to wait until the end to speak, but better yet, to express and be really clear about intent. Do you as a leader already have an idea in mind, or are you genuinely in brainstorm mode? Because so often people assume that leaders already have something in mind, and then it's a, let me try to guess what's in your mind, and then I have to guess the right answer to get on your good side. And I've met and coached so many leaders who are like, I genuinely don't know. Like, I appear confident, but I don't actually know. And the coaching is, leader, if you don't know, say that. Literally say, I don't have a specific outcome in mind. Or here is the current hypothesis, right? Here's what I'm thinking, but the purpose of this meeting is to poke as many holes in this as possible to really pressure test whether it's where we should be investing. And I need each of your different perspectives to help me see what I'm missing. Very different impact than walking to a room and people assume that the leader knows what they're going to do and we're just supposed to guess what's there. Can we be clear on purpose? Can we decide, therefore, also which constellation of people best serves that purpose? Leaders, can you be clear where you are at? Because so often people assume confidence and competence about you when maybe both are not present. And then the other piece that I would add is to be really clear about each of our perspectives, meaning each of our perspectives are limited and legitimate. So being able to say, from where I sit, you know, this deadline doesn't seem to make sense. What do things look like from where you sit? Sometimes that is literally geographically in different places. Sometimes it is, I'm in sales, you're in engineering. And so things look very different. It could be, you know, you in management and me as an IC. But when we're talking about lending our perspective, we worry that we don't know it all. We worry about the pushback. We worry about, you know, so in terms of reducing the risk, it's just to own, but not invalidate our perspective. Right? From where I sit, this is what things look like. What do things look like from where you sit? And then we get the different pieces of data that we need to have a solid data set to look at together.
Sometimes if potentially you put forward your idea, we talk about the pros and cons, it doesn't get chosen, or you go with a different decision. When your ideas aren't selected, or maybe there's a lot of cons around that, it might contribute towards silencing you in the future, putting forward your ideas in the future. I wanted to just explore a little bit on that because I think that you don't want to lose confidence while you're sharing your thoughts and your ideas and opinions.
Totally. There's so many different angles at this, and my own bias that I'll own is to come at it from the angle of what is the responsibility and the opportunity for a leader, because leadership profoundly impacts everyone else's experience. So this dynamic, I'm so glad you raised, because it happens all the time, right? You took the risk to offer an idea or an opinion and it goes into the void, or it gets rejected, or they go a different direction. And oftentimes there's no follow-up, right? There's no, you know, Babisha, that was wonderful. So glad you said something. Here's why we're not doing that. It's just like, did you actually hear me? You know, I spent 6 hours crafting that email and the spreadsheet that went with it. The reason I start with leaders is because the framework I talk about in the book is of three buckets. There are lots of different iterations of this with Racy and others in terms of product management and decision-making, but the three buckets are inform, consult, and decide. Are we clear who is actually the decision-maker? Are we clear whether we're consulting or deciding? Because one of the main friction points is we think we're being consulted, and actually someone else has already made a decision, and it feels like, okay, leader, if you already knew what you were going to do, why did you go through the motions of soliciting input and getting feedback? Because then it just seems like you ignored all of that. That is the coaching to leaders. If there is actually a category, that first bucket of inform, right? The way that we work, particularly if we are iterating quickly, this is true in Scrum too, like you can't consult everybody. So there is a category of people where they just hear about it. And in our effort to be inclusive, we often do a fake consult, right? What do you think? But actually, I don't care what you think because I already know what I'm going to do and I already did it yesterday, which then undermines trust. So really being clear, are we at a point in the process where I'm genuinely looking for input? And if not, it is okay. But communicate that and be intellectually honest that that's not where you're at, because doing the fake consult is going to further undermine trust. Then there is the friction point where we think we are joint decision makers, but then someone just makes the decision single-handedly. And then we're like, but you didn't, where I have no authority, right? This is, why did I spend all the time and energy if you were just going to do what you were going to do again, like you always do? And that takes me back to, can we clarify our different interpretations of which bucket we're in? Because if you think you're the sole decision maker, but I think I'm also a decision maker, we should have that negotiation to clarify beforehand. Because my responsibility, if I'm just consulted, is to advocate for what I think is best, to bring my perspective, my ideas. And I also know that if I'm being consulted, I'm not the end decision maker. Right. So when I'm coaching, I'm often asking people, well, whose call is it? Because if it's unclear whose call it is, then we are more likely to get in that friction point. If it's not your call and you are being consulted, your responsibility is to bring forth your best ideas. They, management or whoever is actually the decision maker, may or may not take it. But there's no offense there because you've at least done your responsibility, which is I'm bringing this data set. They're consulting with a bunch of other people who have other data. And very naturally, they have a different data set based on where they sit that we're going to trust from there. They make the best decision. But I'm really clear, I'm not a decision maker. Mm. My role is just to advocate, to bring my perspective. And then if I think I'm supposed to be a decision maker, let me have that negotiation, which is a different topic.
Yes, yes. That's so important for companies that are at early stage where potentially the founder has previously been doing the product role. They've now handed off parts of what they used to do to a new product manager that's come in. Yes. But sales teams that are potentially out there selling and getting a lot of feedback and input from clients and potentially they might get a lot of signals, but they are, everyone's quite attached to what they hear and their ideas and there's pushing from all angles.
Yeah.
So the product manager who needs to make or steer the product or who's been handed over that responsibility, they put them in a very difficult position. This, what you've just spoken about would be very helpful in that situation for them to know, like, from the, particularly from the founder point of view, are you consulting me? Do you really want me, do you want me to guide you or do you want me to make the decisions? Are you making decisions?
Yes. And if you're a founder and you have delegated that decision-making, actually delegate, right? Don't faux delegate. Don't say, okay, sales or VP or whoever, it is your call, but then undercut it and override it. If you have delegated that decision, you are in the consult bucket or you're in the inform bucket. And as a, you know, as a founder, you cannot scale, you cannot grow if you don't let go of certain decisions. If you can't trust the people you've brought on your team to make those decisions, do you have the right people? Actually would be the question that I would ask first. But again, that's another pain point. It's really hard to let go of your baby. It's really hard to break those patterns when you've had to do it all. And you're actually undercutting yourself if you say that someone else makes the decision, but then you undercut it. Or, you know, you're a bottleneck if you need to be consulted on everything. So can you get clear on what topics, even as a founder, you're on the inform, right? I don't need to know because I trust you and I know, right? I hired you, I brought you on because of your expertise. So run with it and then inform me. Like I need to know, but I don't need to decide.
Hmm.
Or maybe you're not ready to let go yet and be really honest about that.
I think that's so helpful just to be honest. I think just for me to know, do you want me to give you advice and I can bring in the toolkit, I can give you suggestions and mm-hmm. you make the decision, that transparency of what are the expectations yes. rather than pretending that I'm the product owner and you're not. Yeah. And it's just yeah. so frustrating internally, like trying to navigate that space. It's okay, I'm expected to be a leader yeah. here, but I can't lead. Like
complete. And then we burn out and we get cynical. Right. And why would I put my best efforts towards something that isn't going to matter or isn't going to make an impact? We all understand that you can't do everything all at the same time. So I love your example there of, do you want suggestions? Do you want it or do you not? Right. And for each of us to say, you know what? In the next 3 months, we just are not at a place to be able to metabolize any of that information. So can you hang on to it? Or, you know, dump it here into this doc and we'll tackle it there versus the trying to do everything, but not doing anything well. And the confusion amongst people because of what you say, right? I really want to hear what you have to say. I really care what the customers are saying. Give it to me. But are you aware enough that you can't actually metabolize it? Mm. And that takes a lot of awareness and discipline. But not talking about it and letting that disconnect between what you're saying and what you're doing perpetuate doesn't actually serve you, right? Further undermines trust, further leads to disengagement on the team, lack of empowerment, everything that gets in the way of us doing the things that we really care about.
Let's talk about another dynamic that comes to mind. People use their voice varying degrees. There is often a dynamic where you have somebody that's very freely able to speak and might hog the space in the room yes. or like suffocating other people in the room.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that dynamic from both perspectives of the person who is quite confident and able to speak freely versus people in the room who are a little quieter and want to use their voice, but don't manage to find the space
yeah.
to speak.
Yeah. So many layers. One of them is it takes me back to process. So let me just put a post-it note there of how if we do not actively design our workflows, right? Mm-hmm. Bad things happen. If we do not actively design the way we communicate, we default to the communication patterns and preferences of the people with the most seniority or the most organizational power, which often does not support the voices of people who are not wired like them. So this is why I want to zoom out first and say, I love what you described of the person who talks and talks and talks and takes up the space. And not all of us are wired that way. Why is that? There are some people who are real-time processors. The more they talk through something, the more clear things get. Then there are some of us who are post-processors, meaning in the meeting, I can't quite figure out what to say, but 20 minutes after the meeting, I'm like, that's what I wanted to say, right? Mm. And so often post-processing in the workplace is categorized as a weakness, mm. right? You need to be quicker on your feet. If I could just figure out how to say it in the meeting, then I would be heard. Versus that's a fundamental difference in wiring, and we're not even getting into technical neurodiversity.
Yeah. You're kind of seen as timid. That's a word that's come up a lot, is they kind of view yes. it like somebody that's timid and you need to be
yes.
old and
brave. Yes. So, but that is wiring. It's not weakness. It's difference. Our workplaces and the expectations in our workplaces are actually quite narrow. We're all supposed to look preferably like white cis men, and we aren't. And no matter how much we try. So It's actually, an example in the book of that's a really hard pairing a real-time processor with a post-processor, because the more this person talks, the more this person wants to withdraw. Versus, can we design the way we communicate? We have our meeting, our real-time meeting. Here's where we're circling, you know, the decision that I think we're leaning toward. Everybody go home, post-process, sleep on it. And as things come up, put it, you know, reply all on the email thread or put it in this Slack channel, so that the people who are wired differently still have a voice. And by designing differently and elevating communication modes and mediums that play to people who think more clearly, communicate more effectively by typing than talking, we're, you know, taking away, we're creating even playing ground rather than creating, or more even playing ground, rather than creating additional barriers to be heard, that in order to be heard, in order to be seen as a leader, you have to look and sound this way. And, you know, I often think a meeting in our careers is not a Hamilton musical. It's not shoot your shot. And if you miss the one shot in that one meeting, then all is lost, right? Can we, with some intentionality and awareness, redesign the way we communicate that really optimizes for voice rather than just getting us the loudest or fastest voices rather than the best and clearest ideas?
Have you seen a team or experienced a team that have done it well? And can you tell us about their process and how they did it?
Yeah. So I actually love this. Carrie Newhoff, another author, researcher, did it only on the dimension of time of day. Because when we talk about communication preferences and wiring, right, some of us are morning people, some of us are night owls. It always surprises me. Some people, their power hour is in the middle of the day, which is not true for me at all. And of course, we're working across time zones. We tend to assume when we plan a meeting that all time is equal, which the reality is not. So Carrie ran a study with one of the Intact teams he was working with, and they had, you know, their all team, all hands meeting at 1 p.m. They were all local, all in the same time zone. This is right after lunch, right? And if when you step in, back and think about it, it's like, that does not seem like a good idea. That doesn't seem like that would be everyone's prime time. And indeed, red, yellow, green, meaning green is your best hours, you're firing on all cylinders. Yellow is you're still pretty good, but you shouldn't do your highest level work then. And red is like, just do rote email, you know, or check out. And everybody at that 1 o'clock hour was either in their red or yellow hour. So they moved the same meeting, same purpose to 9 a.m. and were far more productive and people were far more engaged. That's just on one dimension of time of day versus, you know, should this even be a meeting, right? The meme that meeting could have been an email exists for a reason. And there's no blame here. It's we're all caught up in the habit of how we've done things, and it takes energy to reimagine. But when I'm working with teams, it is this question of, you know, all these different dimensions, virtual, in person, phone, video, asynchronous, real time, what mediums and modes best support your voice makes it easiest for you to communicate? Does your manager know that about you? Do you know that about your manager? If not, that is a 30-second conversation in one one-on-one that saves so much trial and error and pain. And so often when I'm facilitating a workshop, I'm literally having people have those conversations, right? If it wigs you out every time I pick up the phone and call you, and also you work better by typing, actually, we both work better than typing, then why are we still doing phone calls? Unless that actually serves the purpose of our communication. So examining those dynamics and remembering that we can actually design them rather than have to stay in the same patterns we've been in has been really powerful.
Yeah. And I think there's like the example you gave, like so many teams are moving towards Slack now and writing everything in Slack and pages in Slack. And that might not be suited to everybody.
Totally. And given that we're all different and we work, you know, in really large teams, this is not to say this is the only way you can communicate with me, right? Or that we all have to go only on Slack now. Slack is a tool. It has pros and cons. It supports some people's voices and it undermines others, or it does not play to other people's strengths. How can we design a combination of things that optimizes for voice? The other thing that's really powerful, though, is actually the mere act of discussing these different preferences and wiring already helps. Because instead of thinking, oh my gosh, you have no idea, you're incapable of, you know, you're just so timid. Let's use your example. You're so timid. I now know, actually, your best thinking will show up in an email or in Slack later. And that's fine. Right. If we have planned ahead, that is usually fine. And so let me just stick that question in your mind now, let you post process, and then you'll get back to me. And I no longer, there's not that edge to it of weakness or timid or you're flawed. It's just, I have a better sense of how you work. You have a better sense of how I work. And we therefore can better understand each other rather than misinterpreting each other's behavior because we're not the exact same person.
Yeah. I think that's just so important to realize because like you mentioned earlier, there's a stereotypical type for a leader of what we think. And it is normally, you know, the white guy. And, you know, women are expected to, of all personalities, all different types of personalities expected to fit into this. And if you're not that, then you're not a good leader or you're a weak leader. I think it's so important to start appreciating and recognizing different talents as different types of personalities as leaders. And everybody has something special about them that makes them something unique that might make them a leader.
Totally, including as we're thinking about building our own companies, right? Starting out ventures, what are we building? Are we innovating or are we just imitating? And because so much of best practice in the world, you know, I want to have enough humility to learn from people around me. One of the things I've also learned is really interrogating, is that advice right for me? Is that best practice? Does that fit for who I am and what I want to build? Because a lot of best practice, as I've started to interrogate, comes from white men who have full-time caregivers at home, which is not the state that I am in. And even writing this book, Unlearning Silence, was looking at books that white men and white women had written. And there's a huge blind spot around power and identity and privilege that I think we need to tackle. You know, it's something abysmal, like 7% of leadership books are written by women. And so really thinking, just doing another beat as to what is best practice, where does it come from, does it apply to me, and also what am I building? So I'm not just replicating with the same flaws and challenges, but hopefully building something that is in alignment with my values and the way that I want to see the world evolve.
I have a few more examples to go through if you have time.
Yeah.
And they're more related to, they are quite related to things that I've heard female founders sharing. Let's just go through a scenario that was submitted by a co-founder. So she said, my name is Jan. I'm the co-founder and CPO of tourhero.com, a social travel platform pairing like-minded individuals to travel together. On this topic, I think many times as women, we're taught to be quiet as a child. I was one of those children. I was taught not to cause trouble. My emotions are too much. If someone catcalls me, ignore them. On the emotions end of the spectrum, I was taught not to speak. On the other end of physical safety spectrum, keep myself small, don't draw attention. Translating this to being a founder, I ingrained and it takes a lot of conscious effort to take up space, speak my mind, and not be so critical with myself. I'd love to know what are some very simple exercises to do on a daily basis that can help shift this mindset. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Such a great question. And a huge empathy, right? I think Jan put it beautifully, if so many of us learned and benefited from staying quiet. You were the good kid, the good student, you got rewarded for that. You were a good entry-level worker, all of those things. So one is continuing to ask yourself, what do I think? What do I need? Another is a trick that comes that therapists often employ, right? If I were to use my voice, what would I say? And that little bit of, if I were to do it, rather than I'm just going to come out and use it, mm-hmm. allows us to engage. The other piece, it's similar, is a, you know, if you had a magic wand, what would you change? Because we're releasing ourselves from the constraints of reality and of critical analysis to say, this is what I really want to do. And the thing about, so if I had a voice or if I had a magic wand, this is what I would do, allows you to get to the same spot, but short-circuiting some of the, you know, details, nuances, baggage from our upbringing. You can also replace that with, if I had a seat at the table or at the table I'm building. Right. So if you are creating something, you are you have the opportunity to fundamentally shape it differently. And I am a big believer in double loop learning. Single loop learning says if you don't like the outcomes, change the behavior. Double loop learning, this is Chris Arduous, organizational psychologist, says behaviors that don't come with mindset shifts don't actually change in a sustained way. So if you really want to change, you need to look at not just the behavior that's driving the outcome, but you need to look at the mindset that is driving the behavior. So all of the, if I had a voice, or if I had a magic wand, or at the seat I'm, you know, at the table I'm building, those are all mindset pieces that get you a shift to then drive a different behavior, which drives a different outcome. That's where I'd start with the mindset piece of the more you do it, the more normal it becomes. So this is paired with doing small experiments, right? And a small experiment, the one I mentioned in the book is, you know, I'm sitting in the back of a taxi cab and I wanted to open the window and I sort of debated with myself for 20 minutes, do I ask the driver to open it or not? Because I could bear it. Like, I'm a tough cookie. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to be a bother. I don't want to take up space. And then I also thought, I'm never going to see this driver again. From a physical safety perspective, we're on a busy road, so it's unlikely that I'm going to end up in a ditch in the woods, right? And so I experimented with saying, sir, could you open the window? He didn't say anything. He just pushed a button. And like the most glorious fresh air came in the car. So knowing where you're at and what is a low risk experiment to take up space. And taking up space means expressing perspectives. The low risk could be both, you know, you're never going to have to see them again, or it's not really something you care about. Right, wherever you're at, I share the taxi cab one as an illustration of where I was at. And it's a lot easier for me to ask cab drivers now than it was 5 years ago when I started doing those experiments. The beautiful thing about an experiment is it's not attached to, success of an experiment is not attached to a specific outcome. Right? But what do you learn from that? So the repetition of trying different things tends to have the net impact of, oh, I said that, I expressed that perspective, and it was okay. Mm-hmm. I might have even gotten what I want. So those mindset shifts paired with experimentation is where I would start.
Thank you for that. Yeah. Joy. That was very helpful. Moving on to a couple more scenarios that I've come across in this space, the next two are to do with investment. A common situation that I've heard is that a man and a woman might walk into a room with investors, and the woman is seen as an assistant. They're asked to go and get a, grab a cup of coffee, and the man, all the questions are directed to a man. What would the female founder in this situation, or both founders, do?
Yeah. This one strikes close to home because I have often been the only female traveling with my older white male colleagues, you know, flying business class. And then everyone assumes that I'm his special friend. And I'm like, no, I am, you know, we are equals in professional equals. This is one that I would really put on a co-founder. This is where they can show up as an ally or an accomplice, whatever language you want to use. But the biggest thing the co-founder can do is redirect the questions to the woman to not take up space and not play into the stereotype, right? So, and this is often subconscious. It's cited in the book a lot, particularly in tech. You erase the female co-founder. So when we're talking about, you know, the most successful people or the hottest new founders, even press will just show the male photo. So this goes back to, we each have a responsibility from press, you know, from your marketing materials. Are you equally situated? Are you doing what you can to combat those stereotypes? Are you being clear we are co-founders, or even putting her first? And then when you walk into the room, positioning each other as founders. And then if they're directing all the questions to the guy, I would put it on the guy to redirect. And presumably, if you have a co-founder that you trust, I would assume they would be someone willing to do that role to acknowledge your co-contribution to this. Much harder for the woman in that situation to be like, hi, I'm actually the founder here. Right? Versus what are all the different chess pieces that you can move with the positioning, with the visibility, and then in that moment to disrupt the patterns? And the biggest opportunity to me, the highest leverage point, also because the biases are they'll hear it better from the man. They'll shield the redirection better from the man, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. It's not to say that we can't do it as women, but I'd call on the co-founder there.
We've often heard about how women's capabilities are doubted a lot, and female founders in the like the pitch situation get asked a lot more questions around their pitch deck. Is there anything that can be done about this?
Oh, there's so much that can be done about this. Okay, women aren't getting funded in the same way. Women are more doubted. What can we do? There's that traditional lever of women need to like outperform, whatever. Given the track record of it, how much women have contorted themselves to try to prove themselves to a system that continues to doubt them and is unable to imagine a different face of leadership or innovation, I actually don't think it's on women to do anything differently. It's not like speak in a lower voice or, you know, be more concise. I actually think it's on the system of whether you are able to fundamentally reimagine or broaden your imagination of what leadership and a good investment could be. I seem a little impassioned about this because I am entirely frustrated by it. The other conversation that I'm a part of now is then there's a question of, well, how do we get more female funders, right? Female VCs who presumably can see that potential and disrupt it. So Serena Williams is a fantastic example of that. I'm really glad that that is also happening because I think we're going to need it all. Then there's a piece, though, of the VC worlds in and of itself. What is the purpose of that funding? You know, and also sometimes women saying, I took the money and it completely ruined my life because I lost control. And now I'm reporting to the people who invested in me. And they are expecting basically, we have different goals, right? They want a return on investment at any cost. And that's not in alignment with my values. So that to me is where some of the conversation is right now of, again, can we be intellectually honest of the trade-offs that come with taking that money, because it's not like, oh, I got funded, I've arrived. It comes with a whole other host of things that is often also stacked against us, right? You're supposed to run your startup as if you are a single male with no life responsibilities other than this baby of a startup. And that may be what you're looking for. And if so, fantastic. At least we're going in it with eyes wide open versus I got the funding, I'm celebrating this round. And then there's a divergence in expectation that comes with the investment that I was not prepared for. And it's not actually the company that I want to run or the thing I want to build. No clear answers, but more leverage points is maybe where I'm at.
It would be great just to hear a success story of a company that you've worked with or some individuals that you've worked with that have worked through on learning sites silence. And what have been the outcomes?
Healthier people. I mean, that's sort of a cynical place to start, but the outcomes are, wow, we're actually hearing from our people. From an employee, team member, engagement, retention, health. This is a better place to work because I don't have to tiptoe as much. From a manager perspective, often, I think this is the thing about leaders and managers, which is there's so much good intention. I've actually never met a leader who's like, I want to be a bad leader, or, you know, I don't want my people to succeed. They always say the right things. It's the disconnect between good intention and good impact. And so the success to me is better alignment, that translation of intention actually into impact. For me, unlearning silence as a concept is a little new to say, and then they made $2 billion. So we're sort of still waiting for that. But to me, the employee health, we're addressing the elephant in the room. We talk with each other. You know, there's a lot more clarity rather than, and we're spending our energy doing the work rather than, you know, doing the workarounds around each other. Those are success stories.
Great. Thank you for that. So moving on to the lightning round, we'll wrap up. Okay. So my first question, do you have a resource like a book or a podcast that you've used that you think will be helpful for everybody listening today?
Oh, I'm completely biased, but I think my book, Unlearning Silence, How to Speak Your Mind, Unleash Talent and Lead with Courage, to me is the book that, you know, everyone says you write the book that you needed when you were younger. I say I wrote the book that I still need, because unlearning silence is an ongoing process and it touches every aspect of our lives, which we also know that we're whole people. So what happens at home impacts what happens at work and vice versa. So it's my best effort at writing something helpful.
Great. Yeah, we'll definitely link it in the show notes for this podcast. Is there an individual that you feel is exemplary of somebody who is able to speak their mind and doesn't hold back that potentially our readers could go up and have a look at?
I think there, that's a tricky one. John Lewis in the States, right? We talked about not speaking up because you don't want to cause trouble. And he really rebranded it to say, get in good trouble. What are the things that are worth it to you for the world that you want, you know, the work that you want, where it's worth it to get in good trouble?
Great. Definitely. We'll definitely check him out. What is one piece of advice that has served you well?
Define success for yourself, because if you don't define success for yourself, you'll fall into solving for everyone else's definition.
Very wise. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time. We've had a really long conversation. You've shared so many insights and tools. I know that this episode today is going to be really helpful for everyone listening. Thank you.
Thanks.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast episode today, please do hit the subscribe button and share this episode with like-minded connections. I'd also like to take this opportunity to let you know that I'm sharing knowledge on how to build tech products. If this sounds like something that's going to be helpful to you, please subscribe to the SheFiles newsletter. The link will be in the show notes.